So, hello, everybody. Can you hear me? I hope. So here is Exodus 20, 10 words for today, fitting into our series theme, Who Shall We Serve? I know my colleague, Keith Graber Miller, when sermonizing or teaching, as a symbol of the ground. My inclination is a little different. I like to move to another language. I like to start things. Baruch Ata Adonai Elohim Melech Kilot Makom Hazeh Umeir Otanu Beor Divarcha. Blessed are you, Yahweh, our God, sovereign of the cosmos, the one who has brought us here to this place, illuminating us with the light of your word. Amen. Now, every sermon needs a humorous aside to begin, just to loosen things up. So here we go, keeping with the Ten Commandments theme. You may have seen this or similar memes that play on the iconic image of Charlton Heston as Moses from the Cecil B. DeMille monumental film, The Ten Commandments, which appeared in 1956. No, though nobody will care. That film was a remake of his 1923 silent film of the same title. This, of course, is a takeoff from the image that was on the top. On this common cutting edge way, we have come to access information, downloading files from the cloud onto our phones, tablets. If we take the humor seriously, however, we can see that it's not just a weak form of entertainment, or a weak and entirely predictable rhetorical strategy in the art of sermonizing, but reveals to us and invites us to think about the assumptions we bring to a consideration of biblical law, including the themes that have been lifted out by Anna and Carl and Kristen and Scott earlier in the series. For example, the indispensable role of ordinary, fearless women who flaunt Pharaoh's murderous decree, or the great commission of Moses to take the message of justice that was emanating from the burning bush into the heart of the empire. The liberation of the people from bondage, remembered as the culmination of God's mighty acts on their behalf. And the great irony of the complaining congregation being fed in the wilderness with manna. What the? Turns out to be nourishment sufficient for the day. Food for soul as well as body. Well, in our society, the Ten Commandments have pretty much been reduced to a political symbol. Whether placed in yards or courthouses, the iconic and historically inaccurate depiction of the conjoined tablets, juxtaposed here with another tablet. This is not, however, one of the original tablets of the Exodus. So it kind of looks like it might be one of that first set that Moses actually, the so-called Geezer calendar, a 10th century BCE inscription identifying the agricultural cycles of ancient Canaan. But using representations of the Ten Commandments intended in our day to make a statement about the role of religion in the formation of our national identity. Used as a political tool to push back against the customary ways in which religion is to be kept constitutionally separate from public institutions. This function seems to have been totally ignored. Initial content and meaning of the commandments themselves are less of our concern. Commandments have become a cipher also for all of the negative prohibitions that are often associated with religious communities, the thou shalt nots. Don't eat that. Think about doing such and such. This is understandable, but also unfortunate, since the negative imperative of biblical law actually represents a kind of nomistic or legal efficiency. It circumscribes a limited domain of prescribed action outside of which there's freedom to innovate. By the way, Exodus 20, verse 1, in this passage, the injunctions that follow are not labeled commandments, but words. Vaydaber Elohim et kol ha-devarim ha-ele. Perfectly good Hebrew words for commandment and other technical legal terms. Five of them are found in Psalm 19 alone. Laws, decrees, precepts, commandments, ordinances, and of course they are more to be desired than gold and sweeter than honey. Even more such terms are found in the 176 verse over the top alphabetic acrostic of Psalm 119. But here in Exodus 20, God speaks all these words. This is not to imply that they are the 10 suggestions or the more or less 10 recommendations. Words of God, after all, are not to be treated lightly. And of course, the words themselves, except for the first one, are expressed in the imperative command form, both positive and negative. The negative injunctions are all categorical negations rather than circumstantial prohibitions. So in other words, not don't do that, but don't ever do that. Thinking of the entire text, the equivalent titles that we use, the Ten Commandments. So using 10 words instead of 10 commandments helps us to understand how the declarative self-identification of Yahweh in verse 2 can function as the first of these words. Well, I just want to quickly, before we go further, say a bit about what I won't be covering today. One is the historicity of the Exodus, or the location of Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb, traditionally associated with Jebel Musa, and for over 1,000 years, a popular pilgrimage site. So I'm not going to address questions of did this actually happen, and if so, where, how did it come to be depicted in this way, etc. Interesting in its own right, but not for today. I'm not going to talk about the composition history of the books of the Pentateuch. I know I can't, you're all muted, but I can almost hear the thank gods. Or about the composition of Exodus or even of the 10 words. It's a complicated literary history. Or I'm not going to address the form of the 10 words. It's some kind of a code, perhaps. And I'm not going to get into a comparison and contrast of the two versions of the Decalogue that we have, one found in Exodus, our text, and the other found in Deuteronomy. So, when I teach the introductory course in biblical studies at the college, there's a particular methodology that we try to instill in the students when approaching a biblical text, or indeed any text, ancient or modern, before moving to interpret its meaning. So we start by defining key terms and themes. We move on then to establishing the context. And then we try to recognize poetic and rhetorical features that reveal how the message is being communicated. So I want to use this as kind of a general framework for introducing the code rather than necessarily a path towards its interpretation. So one important themes in the 10 words make the following list. So we have Yahweh's self-identification, which we'll mention a bit later. The reference to other gods and the requirement for exclusive loyalty. Now this suggests that there are in fact other gods. There are other choices to be made. But if one makes a commitment to Yahweh. There should be an exclusive loyalty. Syncretism is prohibited. The article on idols and images suggests what we call an aniconic tradition, the prohibition of use of images of the divine. This is interesting. There was that oblique reference to the Nehushtan, the bronze serpent that was made out in the wilderness and later gets planted in the temple courtyard and has to be destroyed by Hezekiah because people are worshiping it. Anyway, this is the whole issue of the use of visual representations of the forces of nature and of creation, the created order, is a vexed one in the Bible as well as in post-biblical, kind of experience, religious experience. It's not just the surface level, eschewing of all images that we see. The use of divine name, the reference to not invoking Yahweh's name in vain, lashav, which means empty for emptiness. Now this came to mean at a certain point, don't swear, don't use bad language, don't take God's name in vain by saying, oh my God, or something like that. Doesn't mean that. It refers to false oaths, taking an oath in Yahweh's name and not fulfilling it. And then, of course, Sabbath, remembering the Sabbath, keeping the Sabbath. Here again, a very interesting and kind of vexed history, culminating. It became, for some of the Pharisees and the scribes, a kind of a one-issue ethical theme, right? Keeping the Sabbath, a kind of a litmus test that Jesus challenges and says, ultimately, hey, even the Sabbath, the temple in time, is made for humans and not vice versa. Honoring parents, which is, has more of an economic kind of sense in this than we think of as honoring, giving honor to. And we can see this in Mark 7, where Jesus challenges the practice of declaring money that should be used to financially support one's parents by declaring it a part of an offering. It's called korban. You didn't have to give it to your parents. So a way of circumventing this commandment. The issue of killing, lo titzach, is that thou shalt not kill or thou shalt not murder. Well, Wilma Bailey wrote this great little book on this very question that I would recommend to you. Adultery. This breach of one of our primal relationships was taken very seriously. Jesus also challenged the reduction of the ethical system, condemnation, and says to those who bring the adulterous woman that the one who has no sin should cast the first stone. Theft, perjury, giving false testimony, and envy. Envy is interesting because, we think of it as, a feeling, an emotional impulse, a desire that we can't necessarily control. And so how do you control desires? Well, in Jewish ethics, it's not about the desire, the yetzer. It's about whether you act on it or not. This is more what we're dealing with in this case. Well, so if we come back to this kind of three steps, we look at the context of the 10 words in Exodus. So we're going to look at chapter 19 at least. We know what comes before. Well, 3 months after leaving Egypt, they enter the wilderness of Sinai. And so there are various kind of places There's still a wilderness of Sinai. You can go there to this day, or at least you used to be able to when there was a tourist trade in Egypt. It is impressive. You can believe, you get a sense for what it means to wander in the wilderness when you're down there. And in literary terms, Moses speaks with Yahweh on the mountain. And there is a precursor to the self-identification of Yahweh that comes in verse 1. Because God says, you have seen how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. That's the preamble, the preface. So the people assemble at the foot of the mountain, and God's presence is manifested in thunder, lightning, fire, smoke, and thick cloud. And then we're ready. And God spoke all these words. Well, what about the context after 20? Well, 20, chapter 20, verse 22 through 23, 33 is what we call the covenant code. It's one of the recognizable codes in the Old Testament. There are a series of instructions. No forming of images of silver or gold. Only altars of earth and unhewn stones can be used, as if it were a reminder of the pre-settlement nomadic existence of the people. And then we have a series of case law covering manumission, the regulation of violent acts, the goring ox, property rights, and restitution. So that's our context. If we look for poetic and rhetorical features, of course, we have the divine imperatives, positive and negative. And to me, it always brings to mind a little bit part of the early part of the Declaration of Independence, right? Divine, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men, of course it was men, are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable in light ground our basic beliefs in some kind of transcendent authority. We also note that this code, the 10 words, are embedded in a narrative of liberation from bondage and liberation for justice. The 10 words represents a sampling of legal principles, and it's not strictly form, it's not. All it implies a moral imagination that is needed to extend and adjudicate justice in the community. Biblical law is closely associated with the concept of covenant. A covenant is a contract between two parties or a treaty based on the model of the ancient Near Eastern suzerainty treaties, which typically contain clauses such as the identification of the contracting parties, reference to their prior history, a delineation of their mutual obligations, and loyalty oaths in the form of blessings and curses. Biblical prophecy and its passion for justice is predicated on the same basic principles of covenant. And it goes both ways. We have sinned, we have violated the covenant on the one hand, common refrain, but also the complaint, the lament. Why do the wicked prosper? That too feels like a violation of the covenant, of the obligations of the suzerain. The relationship between Yahweh and the people is construed along the lines of such a suzerain vassal model. So the law in the Bible is portrayed as constituting the obligations of the vassal over against the suzerain. The obligations of the suzerain are often couched in terms of past mighty acts of deliverance. Remember 19:4, I bore you on eagle's wings, or the self-identification, I am the God who brought you out of Egypt. That too fits the covenant model. As Waldemar Jansen reiterates, Believer's Church commentary, it's an excellent commentary God liberates the mixed multitude from slavery and leads them through a dry period. That is wonderful Germanic humor at its best. Only then, he writes, does God give Israel the law and ask for a commitment to it in the context of the covenant. Living one's faith, then, is inherently relational in this scheme and inherently political. Well, I feel the need to address this issue of law and grace because it has been a kind of a mainstay in Christian theology. Law is not the opposite of grace, as some readings or myths of Paul New Testament want to assert. That kind of misreading was and is often part of an anti-Judaistic rhetorical strategy. So that Judaism represents law, or we might say Judaism and Islam represent law, and Christianity represents grace. Nothing like that in the Bible. Rightly understood, it's clear that the giving of the law in the Old Testament is itself an act of grace and is still considered that way. Jesus says, don't imagine that I've come to do away with the law, but I've come to fulfill it. So it provides a framework within which we can exercise moral discernment and ask the question, what might it mean to live out our faith here and now? Well, I said I wasn't going to talk about the comparison between the version of the Decalogue in Exodus 20 and that found in Deuteronomy 5. There are interesting comparisons and contrasts, but stop. There are quite different literary contexts. Enough. But this can't be neglected. There in Deuteronomy 5, we have this very interesting declaration. Every generation must relive that encounter at the mountain and decide who to serve. Yahweh our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. That's the Deuteronomic name for Sinai. Not with our ancestors did Yahweh make this covenant, but with us, all of us who are alive here today. The Lord spoke with you face to face at the mountain out of the fire. So this reflects the spirit of a meme that I really like. Maybe you've seen it. I have the same religion as this tree. Another creature of the created order set against the cosmos. I find the spirit of what we're called to through the Ten Commandments not so different than this. So who will we serve? Well, hopefully something beyond ourselves, our own needs, our own frame of reference. We'll serve ourselves, of course. We'll serve our loved ones. We'll serve our community, starting with the most needy. We may even serve the Pharaoh in a particular season. Serve Pharaoh as sovereign. Let us engage in the hard task of discerning what belongs to Pharaoh and what belongs to God. Our faith life is not a legacy or a birthright, but a new beginning in every generation. God can make Anabaptists out of these stones. But covenanted disciples must come from the ranks of those of us who are alive here today. I want to end with this quote from Marilyn Robinson's latest novel entitled Jack. Jack spends a long night alone with his thoughts. After a while, he observes, light will reveal itself in a very dark room. Not quite as a mist, but as something more particular. As if the slightest breath had lifted the finest dust into the stillest air. Despite recent events, the crises we face are not over. Hold on to hope. Live into the expectation that peers into the darkness with its cloying fear until the light reveals itself, not as a phantom, not as a self-deceiving certainty, but as something more tangible, more subtle, as if the slightest breath had lifted the finest dust into the stillest air. Amen.